So here we have two different models for the life of text, the life of writing, or the life of fiction. One is this kind of disclosed, almost religious sense of a kind of spiritual logos, and the other side is a kind of virus. And I'd like to say that the way to understand, one way to understand the liveliness of Dick's writings, the way that they enter into the culture in general, the way they enter into your life as a fan, the way they enter into the writing about those texts, has this kind of liveliness, which is not like just any other author that some people might be really into and might influence the culture in certain ways. That there's something specific going on there that we can also see in a somewhat different key with H.P. Lovecraft. So, I just want to talk a little bit more about this idea of the living text. Now, one of the ways I think this whole process gets going, and I want to emphasize again that I'm not saying there's something supernaturally powerful about Dick's writing, that it has to do with the way that the writing itself presents itself. Now, one of the interesting things when you read Dick is that there's a lot of books in his books. There's a lot of things that are inside his text that are other texts that people read in certain ways, that actually influence the world in certain ways. There, we've already been talking about Manheim Castle, so there's The Grasshopper Lies Heavy. There's also, of course, The I Ching, which is in some ways a book, in some ways not quite a book. It's very alive, it's very interactive. You can talk a whole lot about the I Ching as a really important structuring device. It's incredibly significant to me that the I Ching, which I take enormously seriously as a powerful text, one of the great classics of the world, that Dick not only was interested in it, like a lot of beatnik types in the late 50s and early 60s, but that he used it, that he practiced it, that he submitted himself to the apparent randomness of the coin toss as a structuring device, as a garden of forking paths for his great fiction, for this great work. That this work that is so well composed that it deserves its canonization, both in a science fictional sense and as a piece of American literature, that despite that composition, there's an element of submission to an apparently random process that invokes this kind of liveliness of code and information. You can talk a lot about the way the I Ching is structured in terms of code and mathematics and information, but I won't do that. To mention some other books, of course, there's How I Rose from the Dead in My Spare Time, and So Can You. Very important book that serves as in a way, another kind of I Ching. A number of these books are accessed randomly in order to get their information, i.e. the conventional linear temporal model, very important in terms of orthogonal time, the temporal model with which we read most of our fictions is ruptured in some of these, or our scriptures are like the Bible, is ruptured in this process of random reading. As a side note, this process, this kind of divination itself goes way back to classical times. It's a device called the Sortes, and they would do it with Virgil, they would do it with the Bible, and it was a way of, like, I have a question, so what am I going to do? I'm going to open the text at a time and go like that, and lo and behold, there I have an answer. There I have an answer. There's one of the most significant moments of this that we have in the literature of antiquity is St. Augustine's account, and I choose this this event consciously, the account of Augustine's own conversion. So Augustine, of course, was a Manichaean. He thought the Christians were stupid. He had a rough life. He was, you know, confused. And at some point in his own narration, in his own autobiography, in some ways one of the first genuine autobiographies where we feel actual psychological tension and a sense of a vexed interiority is in his confessions. He's sitting under a tree, and he basically is having a nervous breakdown. He's toast psychologically. And he hears a child singing, tole, tole, take, take, read, read. And he goes, okay, I'm totally desperate. And he had some writings of St. Paul that he was, you know, critiquing. And he opened it up to any page, and he read the first phrase, and I don't even remember what the scripture was, but because it was fairly banal, but it was basically like, you know, believe in Jesus and you'll be saved. And that's his moment of conversion, and he goes on to be Augustine. So we have this idea already in the I Ching and the Sortes that the life of the text is more than just our reading of it, that there's some kind of power or potential in the memes that are inside these texts, their ability to come in, to influence us, to transform us from within. And so one more example from Dick, and I'm going to blow it on my memory on this time. I'm sure one of you guys are going to help it, but I'll put it in terms of a quiz, is what's another Philip K. Dick story in which the wub appears? Not Beyond Lies the Wub, but
Not
the...
Beyond Lies Cover.
That's it. That's the one whose name I cannot remember. Not by its cover. So what happens in that tale is that by... taking the wub fur, I'm really happy that the wub has come up a couple of times already, is this very significant story that in some ways sets up this fundamental, you know, psychological, even spiritual, religious issue of like being taken over by an entity, which may be God, which may be the Yithian race from the, you know, the shadows out of time, that creature then has this nice fur, and if you bind the texts with this fur, the texts begin to change. The texts themselves are in some ways kind of alive, or at least they absorb the life of this not quite alive, not quite dead thing of the skin, the sort of packaging or whatever. So there we really have what I'm saying is that Dick's writing is already kind of pointing us to what it wants to do. It's already giving us little models of how to read it, or one way of reading it. And that this mystery, which already is fully going before 2374, just runs riot after that point. And that, of course, Vallis, and I know that David Hyde's going to talk about this later, so I don't want to talk about it too much because it's a really, really fascinating issue, is Vallis then becomes the great example of this, where you have Dick citing, in some sense, himself, citing his own writing as a scripture that's external to him, but of course is his own production in another sense, and that the way that those ideas impact and enter into that particular text, which is of course one of the most important novels. It's the one that's the most interesting if you are interested in him as a real person, if you're interested in his autobiographical aspects, if you're interested in 2374, you're going to turn to Vallis. And Vallis is there's some very interesting things we can say about Vallis as a, in literary terms, but in literary terms that I hope will now be charged by these issues that I've already raised. So one of them is that he quotes his own scripture, that this material that he's producing, clearly largely for himself, clearly largely, especially as the years go on, not for publication in any specific sense. But earlier on, it's a little bit unclear, and once he's working towards Vallis, then we know that in some sense he's going to be shaping his own speculations as a kind of scripture. And indeed, he begins to read himself. So he's simultaneously the prophet and the exegete. In the exegesis, he goes, no, what the Maze of Death was really about was this, and I was actually saying this. So he's saying that my intentions as an author when I was producing that text were occluded, that what it was really about was coming through on some other level, that something else was writing this text through me that now, in my enlightened state, I can now understand. So it's a completely wonderful and bizarre situation of a prophetic author reading his own fictions as signs of some other metaphysical truth. And he weaves this into the text Vallis for us, for his readers, partly by quoting it as a Tractatus, as a scripture, but also in the way that Vallis quotes everything. It's full of citation. It's full of references. It's full of Wikipedia. It's like the Dick Wikipedia. You just go through, especially the first half of Ballast, the autobiographical half, and you just follow all those little lines, and you're going to get a really good picture of his general philosophical cosmological space. Gnosticism, pre-Socratics, Zoroastrianism, certain ideas in Hinduism. It's all there. And so he's filling that text with all of these references because he wants to make a certain kind of text that's really unusual. And what that text is most like in his fiction is the three-dimensional holographic Bible from the Divine Invasion. The three-dimensional holographic Bible from the Divine Invasion is what I believe is the closest to his ideal form of textuality. And in that you have scripture, but it's 3D, so you can change it. And every way you look at it, he talks about this, every angle you look at this three-dimensional matrix, no longer a linear A to B, but a matrix of code and reference. Every angle, you see new connections, new symbols, new superimpositions. And anyone familiar with, like, particularly with Midrash, particularly with the history of reading the Pentateuch, will recognize, yes, this is what we're talking about. Or going to Dante and looking at the different levels of interpretation. So he's rediscovering or invoking very old ways of interpreting, but in this new viral, hypermediated, kind of psychologically intense, arguably paranoid kind of framework. Now, the last thing I'll say about Vallis is, again, I mean, I really, really believe that like his some of his best books, it's thoroughly, thoroughly composed. He knows exactly what he's doing in that book. And to the degree to which he is sort of trying to say, hey, check this out. This might be real, or this might be something that has meaning for you, or this might be, maybe he can't even help it. Maybe he has to do it at this point. Maybe it's demanding. The only way that he can write is to write with this idea of some kind of transmission, of some kind of proselytizing, to use a crude word that's not really appropriate, but gets the idea across, that there's some kind of infection that he wants to enter into the reader. So, if you remember, the basic structure of Ballast is the first half is largely autobiographical, with this split author as a